At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Rewound the clock since the Puritans got the shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock. If today any shock they should try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock would land on them. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking wasn't absorbed as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes.
Well, as Cole Porter immortalized in his classic 1934 song, Anything Goes, it does seem that in olden days, the slightest glimpse of an ankle or wrist peeking out from layers of Victorian lace could provoke apoplexy among some staid, buttoned-up sensibilities. Styles and attitudes that frowned upon any display of neck, chest, back, or arms during the day could give way to elegant ball gowns with sloping décolletage for the upper body and bustled skirts complete with trains that fell to the floor for an evening at Delmonico's. All of this does make one consider whether one was a straight-laced Victorian or not, just what was going on under there in terms of undergarments. Well, what did Mrs. Astor wear under there? In this episode, I am joined once again at the Gilded Gentleman table by listener favorite author and fashion historian, Dr. Elizabeth Block, for a look not only beneath the glitter and the gold, but a look beneath the satin and the lace to see just what was really going on. Hello, I'm Carl Raymond, the host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast, where every 2 weeks we journey into corners light and dark for a look at America's Gilded Age, France's Belle Époque, and England's late Victorian and Edwardian eras. Anyone who has seen the Hollywood classic film Gone with the Wind cannot help but remember the famous scene during which the young Scarlett O'Hara is pulled into her tight-laced bodice while gripping her bedpost and trying not to breathe, but still survive. And while this certainly doesn't look comfortable, there is a notion that women throughout much of the 19th century and perhaps even before were painfully strapped into their elegant satin and lace-edged gowns, which resulted in a night at a ball or an evening at the opera being akin to medieval torture with frequent fainting spells. The role of undergarments, particularly in the Gilded Age, that last third or so of the 19th century in America, was an important one. There was an evolving concept of what the ideal female shape was, and without very specific underneath engineering and construction, those gowns sweeping the ballroom floor would never look as they were intended to look. From the famous wasp waists to more forgiving approaches to silhouette, it was the choice and style of one's undergarments that often contributed more to one's look than the gowns themselves. My guest today, Dr. Elizabeth Block, returns to the show following our wonderful episode together last spring on the couture fashion houses of Belle Epoque Paris to help lift the hem, so to speak, of the style, form, and function of women's garments during the Gilded Age. Dr. Elizabeth Block, an art and fashion historian, is senior editor in the publications and editorial department at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Dr. Block earned her PhD in art history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York with a focus on 19th century U.S. painting. She also holds an MA in American Studies from Columbia University and a BA in English and Art History from George Washington University. Her book, Dressing Up, The Women Who Influenced French Fashion, was published by MIT Press. It is the winner of the Victorian Society in America Book Award of 2022 and was shortlisted for the Association of Dress Historians also in 2022 for Book of the Year. Dr. Block's next book, Beyond Vanity, The History and Power of Hairdressing, will be published by MIT Press in September of 2024. And as a teaser to listeners, Liz will be back with me once again when her new book is published. Liz, I am so honored and pleased to welcome you back to the Gilded Gentleman table and have you right here across the table from me.
My favorite place to be.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Liz, you know, our show together on Gilded Age Fashion, The House of Worth and Beyond last year was based on your book, Dressing Up, and it was truly one of my most listened to shows of the past year and one that resulted in so many listeners sending me emails and notes and Instagram. Everybody seems to want to know about fashion, but you had the same experience, too. You heard from a lot of listeners, right?
Absolutely.
Everyone's curious, right? Well, now, today, we get to go undercover.
That's right.
Sorry, I just had to say that. So there's an awful lot to say, so let's start here. So one of the most important things about undergarments is that they actually served several really important key functions. First, to keep those beautiful, delicate fabrics away from any perspiration or dirt on the body. But then secondly, they gave the clothes that went over them a shape. So I'd actually like to begin by going back a little bit. So, Liz, what was the ideal woman's silhouette around mid-century, say the time of the Civil War, and how did it change by the time we got into the Gilded Age of the 1880s? What was going on?
In the 1860s, during the Civil War and just afterward, the ideal silhouette was bell-shaped. So you have very wide skirts, a narrow waist, and a fitted bodice. We can conjure Gone with the Wind here. The skirts could be multiple feet in diameter. I love thinking about how much space women commanded while wearing them. Now, in the 1870s, the skirt, which continues to be the most prominent part of the ensemble, shifts in emphasis toward the back. So we are no longer seeing the wide hoop skirt, but rather a gathering and poofing out of the skirt toward a woman's backside. And as a result, the contrast between the cinched waist and the skirt is not as extreme as it was in the 1860s. The bodice is rather fitted and often embellished with buttons or other trimmings. This general silhouette continues through the 1880s with multiple intervening trends, and we will talk about the bustle later. There's an emphasis on decorative trimming along the bodice and the skirt. These are the dresses with tassels and fringe that we know from Aunt Ada on the Gilded Age show, the one by Gillian Fellows that we're all watching obsessively. You know, Aunt Ada wears those fussy, heavy-looking dresses, and there's lots of tassels and all this. Some of it is resembling upholstery fabrics, if I'm going to be honest.
I want to go back for a second to that mid-century. So that ideal shape, the bell shape, what were the elements, what were the undergarments that were required to achieve that? We all think of the hoop skirt. Was it basically that?
In the 1860s, yes, that wide bell-shaped skirt was supported by a lot of underwire activity, and that would be the cage crinoline, or the hoop skirt, which was invented in 1856, so again, Gone with the Wind. The cage crinoline is a succession of steel hoops that support the weight of those heavy skirt fabrics. Now, before the crinoline, you would have to wear multiple layers of petticoats, and they were very, very heavy to wear. So the crinoline redistributed the weight of the fabric, and you required fewer petticoats. And that's how we get that beautiful hoop and spacious Gone with the Wind look.
Well, those petticoats, I'm sure that kept you warm, too, right? Wasn't that part of that?
Oh, yes. And we'll be talking about flannel petticoats a little bit later when we talk about Consuelo.
So let's stay with the early 1880s for just a moment here. And it seems that a woman's undergarments would actually change depending on what she was doing. So what would have been worn, let's say, during the day? And how would that have changed if one were going to go out in the evening to a ball or a dinner?
This is such an important point, Carl. I'm so glad you bring it up. Undergarments did change depending on the activity. You would wear a bustle underneath your afternoon and evening dresses, and certainly under your ball gowns. Think about Alva Vanderbilt's party of 1883. When you were out socializing, you would have these understructures. But at home, you might wear a tea gown, which was a loose fitting garment that did not require a corset or a bustle.
But if you were receiving guests, for example, people came to the house, you had to put something on, right?
Oh, yes, you'd have the full works. And we will go down how many elements that required.
I can't wait till we get to that section. Now, two of the key elements in the 1880s, and you've talked about them here. One was the bustle or lack thereof, as you just mentioned. And then there's the corset. And boy, is there a whole lot to say about corsets. So I can't wait for us to get to that. But I want to spend a little bit of time on the bustle, because when you and I were chatting on the phone a few weeks back, I was riveted by the bustle conversation. So can you talk a little bit about a bustle, that really odd bump in the back of these Gilded Age women's dresses? What was a bustle and what was it supposed to do?
Yeah, it's a little unfamiliar to us today, but the bustle was composed of collapsible bands of materials like wire or steel or reed. And those circular bands stacked on top of each other, and they were connected by vertical strips of linen. So this is a real piece of architecture that's under your skirt. There's a great example from about 1885 in the Metropolitan Museum of Art that gives a good sense of this. These bustles can get very, very pronounced, meaning they're bringing attention to a woman's backside. And there's what we call the bustle wars during the 1880s. There's two different types of bustles that people like to wear. But there is a very pronounced type that kind of creates a shelf back there. And you can imagine where the emphasis was.
So was that the point of the bustle, was really to draw one's visual focus to the back of a woman, the back and below? That was the point of it?
Yeah, in the 1880s, yes.
How comfortable was that?
You know, people could sit down in bustles. People could sit down in the 1860s before that in cage crinolines. These things collapsed. They were really a remarkable work of engineering. So how comfortable were they? I haven't worn one myself, but I have seen people wear them, especially these wonderful reenactors, and they really show how easy it was to sit down. These bustles collapsed, and you can kind of think of it like a slinky, how the circular bands come up and they come down.
You know, recently I was in a historic house and the guide said a truly fascinating thing. She pointed out a set of chairs, and they still had the original fabric from the late 19th century. And she pointed out the fact that the seat of the chair showed some wear, but the backs of the chairs showed no wear at all. And she explained that this was because the women sitting in them never got their backs against the back of the chair because they couldn't because of the bustles or whatever the undergrounds. And I thought that was fascinating.
It's true. I mean, the bustle did collapse and you could sit, but your back wouldn't touch the back of the chair because part of the magic of the bustle really is to help you with your posture. And so imagine sitting upright like that all day.
Yeah, no slouching here, right? Yeah. Now, how long did the bustle stay in use and why did it disappear and when did that happen?
The bustle disappears in the early 1890s, and that's because the preferred silhouette changes to a more elongated look, a smoother, longer, slimmer look as we get toward the turn of the century. And we also shift focus from the backside to the sleeves. And then in the 1890s is when we get those wonderful large leg of mutton sleeves. So we're bringing the eye upward at this point.
I think that's a really interesting point that the undergarments then supported the gown, which was changing how the eye followed the silhouette of the dresses, correct?
You got it.
Now, when we were chatting, you shared some information on something I dearly love, and you have to talk about this, the lobster bustle. What was this?
Okay, well, I'm an enthusiast of the state of Maine, so anything...
And I'm from the state of Maine.
And you're from the state of Maine.
So we have to talk about the lobster
bustle. That's right. So anything with the moniker lobster, I mean, right? So the lobster tail bustle was a specific type from 1885. So in the 1880s, we've got these bustle wars going on, and different ones are in favor. But this lobster type, it's made of a succession of different sized hoops that form the shape of a lobster tail. And they increase in size as they get to the bottom, the backside, and then they increase again in size. And it sort of helps us envision this curvature that's drawing attention to that area. And since we're talking about specific bustles, I wanted to mention that for girls, there were smaller Mrs. bustles. So like the Mrs. department
of
in
course,
a department
yes.
store. These were a fraction of the sizes of the ones for women. So they were a nod to fashion of the moment while staying in proportion to a young girl's body. So picture a little lobster tail for a young girl of, say, 9 or 10.
Do we actually even know who invented the bustle, or was this some collaborative effort by designers?
Oh my
Do we
goodness.
Know?
There are so many different patents for bustles and corsets, and it's impossible to pinpoint. It's one of these cultural moments where inventions come all at the same time.
So there was no Mr. Bustle that created this thing, right? And with that, Liz and I are going to take a short break, but we'll be back. There is so much more to say.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And we're back. I'm Carl Raymond, host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast. And today I'm with Dr. Elizabeth Block, and we are talking about Gilded Age undergarments. What did Mrs. Astor wear under there? Okay, so now we really have to address the most infamous aspect of all Gilded Age women's undergarments, and that is the corset, which we've danced around a little bit today. Can you talk about when we first started to see corsets? And let's just begin with, what was the function that they performed?
Okay. So this is our reminder that the corset was a piece of structural underclothing. I say that starkly because our sense of the corset has really morphed over time. And, you know, we might associate it with, say, like the bustier top that Madonna wore from made by Gaultier in 1990, or if anyone's watching any red carpets this season, the corset top is ubiquitous. It's just everywhere. But in very general terms, in Western culture, the corset as a piece of underclothing derived all the way from the 17th century. There's a very long history of corsets that we won't go into, but I want to mention that a term used earlier was stays. So sometimes you'll see the word stays related to corsets. But we'll use the word corset. And in the mid to late 19th century, the corset was a split bust. And that means that two panels of sturdy fabric were fastened with hooks and eyes in the front. And at the back, you would tie these cords and pull them tight, tight, tight so that you could get your middle in. And these are the types of corsets that we see in the 1880s during, say, the Gilded Age show. So there were two purposes for the corsets. One, to support the bust, the waist, and the back. And two, to serve as a foundational garment under which your outer garments would rest. So I want to keep that in mind as we talk further.
And what were they made of? It had to be something kind of flexible, I guess. What were they made of?
I love this question about what corsets were made of because there's a lot of misinformation out there. But in the earlier period, so say 16th to 18th century, the way that corsets kept their shape was by using baleen from whales. And this was known as whalebone. That was used for the boning of the stays or the corset. And that those were the elements that would shape the fabric, the sturdier fabric that actually made the two panels that were being held together. But baleen is not actually bone, but it's keratin, which is a soft matter from the jaw of the whale, and it bends very easily. By the 19th century, though, when whales were being killed for their oil to use for lamps and for other functions, whalebone became more difficult to procure, and so other materials were used, like turkey quills, steel, or by the 1870s, celluloid.
That's so interesting. At the beginning, it sounds like it was completely environmentally inappropriate, so I'm glad we sort of moved on to other synthetic materials.
This is true.
Now, one thing that really fascinated me as I was looking into this is that even women, as they became pregnant or they aged, still there were situations where they had to wear a corset. So there was such a thing as a maternity corset. And then again, as one's body changes, as one gets older, there were corsets that could adapt to that. Am I right about all that?
You're right. There are such things as maternity corsets. And our first thought might be that wearing a corset when you're pregnant would be cruel. But because, as I said, the whalebone, or in more casual types of corsets, they would use cotton cording that was even more flexible. The corset did not press down on the belly, but rather provided support when a woman's body was managing extra weight.
So this is really interesting, and I'd just like to take a moment to underline some myth-busting here. So from what I'm understanding is that this is really a bit of a misconception that people have, is that the corset was, you know, a medieval instrument of torture. I'm sure, depending on the material, there was a comfort level, but it could be far more flexible than we have any conception of. Am I right about that, Liz?
So were they uncomfortable? It's this ongoing question. You're right. I mean, comfort is subjective. And it's really difficult to try to apply like an overarching sense of what we consider comfortable now to corsets of really any given time period. So in general, we think that now our new thinking is that corsets supported the back and the bust in a very helpful way and reduced strain on the back and reduced strain on the waist from those very heavy skirts. I want to mention here Alana McKnight and Serena Dyer, who are these wonderful historians. And while we're myth-busting, they've attributed the bad reputation for corsets to male doctors in the late 19th century who blamed corsets for virtually everything. They blamed corsets for reducing birth weights and for deforming the rib cage. And we think now that this may have been in response to growing independence for women in society. And so male doctors were trying to claim that it was anything related to, you know, a woman's undergarments that were causing all of these ailments. And we call this the gender bias in medical research. And it's important here. So with regard to comfort, you know, I want people to consider that corsets were adjustable. Like I said, a regular corset fastens in the front with hooks, and it fastens in the back with lacing. That is really kind of like lacing a sneaker today. You would run the lacing through the holes on alternate sides, and then you'd pull them, you know, as tight as you wanted. And we were talking about maternity corsets before. There were also corsets with breast flaps that could be unbuttoned for nursing. So these were really, you know, objects of engineering.
But what you just brought up is something I think very interesting here is there was an element of choice as to how one wore a corset, and I assume some of these other undergarments. So, am I correct about that here?
You are correct. And one way to drive that point home is to remember that all women took their corset off when they went to sleep.
Well, I can understand that.
And more to your point, I want to remember that women were selling corsets too. I mean, they weren't just, you know, consuming them, but they were also marketing them. So they were selling corsets door to door and serving as agents for these large manufacturers like Reliance Corset of Michigan. So they were selling comfort based on personal experience. So to get to your question of agency and choice, of course, yes, they were making choices.
Now, we could do a whole show on corsets, but I think we've uncovered a lot here, right? Thank you, Liz.
Yeah.
So I'd like to go a little further undercover here. So let's assume that, oh, Mrs. Astor or Alva Vanderbilt, they were dressing for a ball or a grand dinner. So, Liz, can you begin with the most basic undergarment that they would have worn and sort of build it all out from there? What was under there?
It was quite a lineup of items. And of course, it would vary based on the final outfit. But in general, here's the order and get ready. It's a long list. First, a chemise, which is a lightweight cotton or linen gown, or a combination of chemise and drawers. And drawers are what you think they are, underwear as we think of today. Then after the chemise, you put your corset on. After the corset, you put on a corset cover. This is a fabric garment worn over the corset, and it's a little blousier, and it's protecting the corset from rubbing up against an outer blouse. Next, depending on the style of the moment and the figure of the woman, you might tie on some hip pads just to, you know, give yourself a little more curve than you had naturally. Then you might put on your bustle, then 1 to 3 petticoats. And finally, you put on your skirt, stockings, your bodice, which you're going to pull over your head, your jacket, your hat, and your gloves.
And you can still move out the door, right?
Yes.
Now, can you imagine dancing in all of that?
Well, dancing, it's another story, isn't it?
I know. But now you mentioned petticoats here, which we talked about earlier. So these, I'm sure, were much lighter weight than petticoats of earlier eras. But you still had to wear them, right? Because that also helped the shape of the skirt. Am I correct?
Yes, they helped the shape of the skirt, and also they would pick up some dirt off the ground. Remember those, you know, those dirty streets? They would pick up some of that and protect the outer skirt.
You bring up a really interesting question. The streets, which I'm sure people are now beginning to realize were not very clean in the Gilded Age, no matter where you lived. How did women protect? Now, if you were in a carriage, I suppose that's part of it, but how did women protect the hems of their dresses? What happened? How did you keep all that clean?
Well, like I said, this is really the age of inventions and the patents for undergarments and for liners and for protectors for your clothing are in the thousands. But there are these really terrific skirt protector linings that you could add to the bottom. You would button it on to the bottom of your skirt hem, and those would pick up the dirt, and then they were removable, and you could wash them. They were washable.
Now, am I correct? I have this general perception of clothing in the 19th century, particularly women's clothing, is there were a lot of removable pieces. You had your satin or your silk gown, but there were collars that could come off and sleeves that could come off and bits around the bottom that could come off. Is that all true?
That's true, and there are protectors that go inside your armpit area, and those are removable and easily washable because they're made of fabrics like cotton and linen. So lots of changing parts, as you say.
So Liz, I'd like to talk a little bit about just how undergarments were made and by whom. When you were on the show last, we talked a lot about the couture houses. We talked about Worth and Paquin, Maison Félix. So were undergarments also custom made? Were they made and designed too by some of these great houses, just like the gowns?
Well, like clothing, your budget determined whether your undergarments would be custom made or whether you would make them at home or order them from a catalog. There are such beautifully made and designed corsets. And especially later in the century, when the dyes improve, you get these beautiful colored, beautifully hued corsets and other undergarments. So they're really, really gorgeous works of art when they're custom made and also when they're catalog ordered.
So the custom made pieces were done by some of the great fashion houses, or were there certain places that just specialized in undergarments?
Well, depending on your budget, here are the options. You could go to a corset maker for a custom fitting if you had the means, like the Vanderbilts and the Astors, and you could shop in Paris 2 to 3 times a year. You might go to the famous House of Leoti in Paris. Or if you were shopping locally in New York or Philadelphia or where have you, you could shop at any number of makers. And I wanted to name one that I found while I was reading 19th century magazines, because we're just a few steps away. H.P. Olmsted at number 6 East 14th Street in New York. You could also have your maid make you one at home, or you could make your own using a commercial pattern, and then you could decorate it with trimmings like bows that you made on your own sewing machine. That would be well after 1850 when people had sewing machines in their homes. And I mentioned earlier catalogs. You could order factory-made corsets and undergarments from a catalog. And I just have to mention, because you know I like to spend time in libraries, I was looking at a catalog in the Winterthur Library in Delaware for Cabo corsets, K-A-B-O, of New York and Chicago. And in this catalog, you could buy your undergarments by the dozen. And so depending on like which level you were buying at, the more expensive ones were trimmed with lace. You would order them by item number, and they would say what colors these garments were available in. So most of the undergarments we've been talking about so far were in white because they were easier to clean, but some were available in blue and pink. And when you get really into like the stratosphere with some of the great makers in Paris, we mentioned Leoti, and I'll mention this House of Franck in Paris that women in the Gilded Age would have gone to, then you're really getting into the highest quality materials.
Now, I'm sure everybody would want everything custom made, but you bring up a really interesting point that was really gathering steam at the end of the 19th century, and that's catalog shopping. And of course, today we know it all as ordering online. But I think the same problem existed then as now. What about the fit? You know, you see something online, you love it, it's perfect, and then you order it and you get it, and well, it's just not quite right. Do you think the same thing happened with some of this mail order, these mail order undergarments?
I do, because I've paged through those catalogs. They're so fascinating. And you're right, you're buying by style number, and you're buying, you know, based on what your waist is before it's pulled in and cinched. But remember the skills that all these women had. I mean, women were taught to sew and to mend and to hem things starting at age 6. So if you catalog ordered something that wasn't quite right, you could adjust it using your own tools at home.
So Liz, were there any designers that actually specialized in undergarments and lingerie, or were they just made by the same houses that did your gown?
In Paris, lingerie, as it was called, was a specialty trade of its own. And when we last spoke, I might have mentioned how exciting it was when I discovered that there was a lingerie maker in the same building as the House of Worth at 7 Rue de la Paix, and the company name was Franck. And we know from existing invoices that American socialite May Gaulet shopped there for underclothes, including nightgowns, and she had her corsets custom made at Léotie at 8 Place de la Madeleine.
Do we have an idea about the cost of these things? Can you offer any sense of what some of these things cost?
They would be the equivalent of thousands today.
Yeah.
So if your dress by the House of Worth was in the tens of thousands, your corset would be in the probably single thousands.
And with that, Liz and I are going to take a short break, but we'll be back. There is so much more to say.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And we're back. I'm Carl Raymond, host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast. And today I'm with Dr. Elizabeth Block, and we are talking about Gilded Age undergarments. What did Mrs. Astor wear under there? Now, could you share any insight into what was happening in terms of manufacturing and design and style of undergarments between we had France, we had other influences from Europe, and we also had America? What was going on between all of them?
The custom lingerie and corset making trades in Paris were a real source of pride for France. And that's evident in all of the advertising that we see, especially for the World's Fairs. At the Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia in 1876, there were very prominent displays of these makers of lingerie. One that I'll mention is Farcy and Oppenheim of Paris. There's a wonderful black and white photograph of that. In the United States, as I mentioned earlier, there were custom makers that you could go to for a fitting and the catalogs you could order from, depending on your budget again. For instance, I was looking at Godey's Ladies' Book of September 1884, which had drawings of a trousseau set. And listen to what you got with this set. It was comprised of drawers, corset and corset cover with lace and bows, and a lace and bow trimmed nightgown. So that's like a nice package order. You could copy those designs yourself, or you could ask your maid to do so.
Now, can you share any of your favorite examples? Because you've looked at so many, both live and in photographs and catalogs here, of the really exquisite craftsmanship in the undergarments. And I find this fascinating because this is something that would only be known by the wearer and the creator.
Yes.
And perhaps a passionate lover. I don't know. but can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, sure. There's an example in the Met. It's an American-made corset from about 1878. It's made of blue and gray silk, and it has this cloud-like pattern on the main panels and lace and embroidery at the very low bust line. The maker is unknown, but there's a tantalizing inscription in the lining at the back. It says Donita/20. Was it the name of the wearer and her age? Probably not her age. Probably a pattern name, but I still like to think that maybe it was a little secret personal name tag in the back of that corset.
Oh, I love that. Isn't that interesting? Inscribed undergarments. God. Now, it seems that two of the greatest developments in the sale and the marketing of women's undergarments, and indeed really garments in general here, were, number one, there was the tremendous increase in the press towards the end of the 19th century and consequently advertising for all of this. And then number two, particularly here in New York, the elevated rail trains that brought people now around the city, and that helped establish the great department stores, or at least allowed you to get to the great department stores. So women could now travel to shop and they had access to a much wider selection. Can you talk about some of these developments and how they affected the quality and the accessibility of undergarments for women?
Advertising of undergarments, especially corsets, is ever present in these popular magazines and newspapers of the period. I'm telling you, everybody had a new invention to market. Let me just name a few. There was the Hercules supporting corset of 1879, which would support the abdomen naturally, and it was perfect fitting. There was also the Wilsonia corset for day or night wear, and it had magnets in it. It claimed to cure sleeplessness, nervousness, general debility, rheumatism, and paralysis. Now, those are some big claims.
Well, magnets in your corset, what if you like stuck to the wall because
magnets
it was attractive?
In your corset. Do what you need to do. The well-known brand Warner's that we still know today, it would advertise its rust-proof corset, which appealed to customers' fears of rusted metal boning. These are a lot of different considerations. So you mentioned department stores, and they're so essential to this period and to the dissemination of inventions in underclothes as well as in fashion. We have these wonderful department stores like B. Altman in New York, Wanamaker in Philadelphia. Now, at department stores, you might find different types of underclothes in various sections. There is a great board game, if you will allow me to go into this for a second, from the late 19th century in the New York Historical Society. It's called The Game of Playing Department Store. I have no idea how to play it, but I noticed on the game board, which is really vibrantly illustrated, that the stockings, black and white striped, are in the hosiery department. The petticoats, pink with white lace, mind you, are in the dry goods section with the skirts and the cloaks and the hats. Now, who knows how accurate the game sections are, but it's really useful to see how central these items were to the concept of daily shopping in a department store.
I would have loved a game like that, right? When you were a kid?
Oh, it's you know, I have a saved search on eBay.
Now, one thing it's that I want to briefly mention here, because I think it's so important, and I've talked about this in other shows, the whole world of these department stores really represented a whole new world for women, right? They could be out by themselves. It gave them a lot of strength and power outside the home. Can you just comment on that? Because I think that's, while that's not directly related to undergarments, it's important in this experience, right?
It's essential to remember that women were shopping alone or with a friend or with two friends. They were not with male escorts all day long, no.
And what a sense of power, right, to do that.
Yeah, and not just the power of walking the street by yourself or with a friend, but the power of spending your money.
Now, one of the really most fascinating bits that you offer us in your book, Dressing Up, which I just loved, is this notion of fragrance, and how many women would actually have a signature fragrance made up, and sachets of this could be either sewn into the linings of garments or even included in shipments coming from Europe, and certainly in undergarments. So can you talk about the importance of this notion of fragrance and the perfumes that were part of this? Because that was a part of fashion too.
Of course, it was so central. Now, undergarments, as we've said, were preserving the outer garments. That was one of their main roles. So they were made of fabrics that were easily washable. So as I mentioned, cotton and linen that could be laundered regularly. You would boil water and you would wash your undergarments in this boiling water, rubbing hard soap against them. You would wring them out to air dry, and then you would starch and have them ironed. So the scent, when you first put these undergarments on, would be the scent of fresh laundry, so soap and starch. But after wearing them, they would pick up the scent of a woman's perfume. And to name just one of the signature scents that I like to think about, Carolyn Astor preferred wild lavender and garden roses mixed.
And she would have this made up and made into little sachets sewn into her dresses, right?
Oh, yes. Those were in silk sachets about 2 inches by 2 inches, and they were sewn right into the inside of her gowns.
And then when you ordered your gowns from Paris, you'd get the box, and then I assume it was the maid that would open them. But you would again have that scent in the box. That's so elegant, don't you think?
You open that box, and your signature scent is emitted from your box from Paris with your dress. I love it, too.
So, Liz, one of the really great social moments of the Gilded Age and in Gilded Age history was the wedding of Consuelo Vanderbilt. This is Alva's daughter, Alvin Willie Kay's daughter, Consuelo Vanderbilt, her forced marriage, I dare say, to the Duke of Marlborough in 1895. This was an enormous society event. Alva engineered the whole publicity machine around this. And part of this was actually the publicity surrounding Consuelo's trousseau and undergarments. Can you talk a little bit about this? This was all over the press.
This was one of the most publicized international marriages, I think, ever. And we know that Consuelo's wedding gown was made by the House of Doucet in Paris, or other pieces of her trousseau were made by the House of Worth and also by the wonderful New York dressmaker Catherine Donovan. But what about those undergarments that were so central to the press reports? In Consuelo's memoir, The Glitter and the Gold, from 1953, she remembered how obsessed the press was with basically her undergarments, with her underwear. When we read those reports of the items about her trousseau, we have to treat them with a grain of salt, but they are really fun to go through. So let's dive in just a little bit. The Philadelphia Inquirer wrote, quote, "Of the 75 gowns included in the trousseau, not one will be sent out without two pairs of its own particular stockings." Consuelo would mention those stockings and the glitter and the gold, so they must have made a real impression on her. Silk stockings were so luxurious, and there are so few that remain today in museum collections because they would wear so easily. They were so fragile. But where did she get those underclothes? Vogue magazine, in its, you know, multiple-page spread on this topic, said that the underclothes came from the department store B. Altman in New York. And those were likely imported from France and then sold by B. Altman, which we know was common practice. And remember, we were talking about personalized name tags? Well, Consuelo's name was embroidered on her corset covers, nightgowns, chemises, and even her drawers. And not just her name. She chose floral embroidery. And what were her favorites? Rosebuds, daisies, violets, and chrysanthemums. She also had tons of petticoats, according to the press. The most bespoke was a petticoat with ruffles and lace to wear under the wedding gown. But she also had silk petticoats to wear under her walking dresses. Now, she got married in November, so it was winter and it was chilly. So, of course, she had flannel-lined petticoats. The materials were luxurious and they were colorful. There was a pink skirt lined with pink-dyed eiderdown, which was made from the eider duck, a yellow and blue skirt lined with white down, and then she had white petticoats lined with blue and pink down.
I think they sound beautiful, but I've got to say, yes, she was married in November, but then she was about to head off to England and wander around a drafty Blenheim palace. She needed those flannel-lined petticoats. Don't we agree about that?
It's true. There is an aspect of practicality here. Let's give her that.
That is really an extraordinary story of what she had. But also, in addition to all the lingerie, there were clips and buckles and garters, right? All of that sort of hardware, too. Am I correct?
The Vogue article, this multi-page spread, says that her bridal corset had a floral design of carnations and solid gold clips. Now, hold on. Here is where we need to honor Consuelo's statements in her memoir, The Glitter and the Gold. She wrote that she was embarrassed by a report that said she had gold clasps studded with diamonds on her garters. That leads me to question the solid gold clasps on the corset, and that was most likely a sensational description that both Vogue and the New York Times ran with.
Well, they weren't going to easily be able to debunk that, right? So they could say whatever they wanted,
they
I suppose.
They really could say whatever they wanted in the press at that time.
Right. So, Liz, as we move out of the 19th century and we really get into the 20th century, and depending on which historian one talks to, the Gilded Age started to fade sort of around 1905, 1908, and certainly by the beginning of World War I in Europe. But how were undergarments changing as we made the transition from the 19th into the 20th century? What was going on?
Around 1900, the fashionable silhouette was more of a monobust, so like what they called the swan bill chest, with the bust thrust outward, your waist pulled in, and then your lower back forming kind of a back bend. And you'll see this in photographs of the Gibson girl type in the United States. So that's around 1900. By 1910, those dresses are slim and the silhouette was straight rather than curvy. So the corset wasn't needed anymore. And brassieres were invented. You wore your brassiere with a girdle. So curiously, around this time, there were some men's corsets that crop up, and they puff out the men's chests to exert masculinity, perhaps in reaction to the less curvy feminine look, quote, feminine look, that was coming in for women. Now, by the 1920s, we get that more drop waist and the straight body flapper look, and by World War I, corsets are gone.
Boy, we've come a long way, right? Over probably 50 years.
We certainly have.
Yeah. So, Liz, I'm so curious your take on this. As we watch shows like HBO's The Gilded Age or some of the other historical dramas or films set in the period, are there any misconceptions that you think modern viewers need to correct in order to better interpret how they see the clothes that we're given on the screen?
Yes. Well, first I want to reiterate that cotton and linen underclothes sat closest to the skin, not the corset. This is the one that drives historians watching these shows and films the most batty. So the chemise is closest to the skin, not the corset. After that, I would draw attention to the time and labor that went into dressing. Remember that whole long list I went into about first your chemise, then your corset, then your drawers. The final look was achieved only after all those underclothes had been sewn, laundered, mended, and sat in place smoothly to best support and display the exterior bodice and all those beautiful fabrics.
Now, when we did our last show on Gilded Age fashion, gosh, it was almost a year ago now, what have people been asking you? We said at the top of the show that I know you've received a lot of notes and emails and Instagram posts, as have I, but what have people been asking you about fashion since then? What are some of the areas that people are most curious about and they find most fascinating?
There seems to be an increased interest in how garments were cared for, both in their cleaning and in their storage. And we touched on this earlier when we talked about how undergarments preserved the outer garments. The undergarments touched the body and they were cleaned more. So there's a big interest in laundry, which I'm getting really, really interested in, thanks to all these questions that I'm getting. But the line of inquiry is also really encouraging to me because it shows that people are thinking about preservation, and maybe it will lead to more appreciation of old garments in family trunks and attics, and who knows, maybe more discoveries. Oh, Carl, I'm also getting questions about how couture garments were stored. So maybe it's time for a book on Gilded Age closets.
Okay, there's a book coming on laundry. There's a book coming on closets. We could do this. Do you have any comments? Because people have asked me this, and I certainly don't know. What about dry cleaning? Now, certainly today, we just take things to the dry cleaner and not think about it. But apparently, there were sort of some rudimentary beginnings of dry cleaning in the 19th century. Can you offer any insight on that?
Well, I've seen kerosene come up. there were a lot of flammable ingredients that were being used to clean clothing, but mostly and most practically, you would brush your clothing free of dust. So those really delicate silks in the outer garments, you had an upholstery brush, really, or a clothing brush that you would brush the dust and the dirt, and then you would kind of spot clean.
So, Liz, you truly are the most thorough of researchers in doing your work. Can you share what some of your best sources have been, either in preparing this show or, and even in your own brilliant work? Where can listeners find out more?
If I had to name one book, it would be Valerie Steele's The Corset, A Cultural History, which is a terrific source. Valerie Steele's the director and chief curator of the museum at FIT in New York. That's the book source I would give. Now, there are such wonderful scholars working on underclothes. I mentioned Alana McKnight. She's a dress and labor historian. Serena Dyer, a dress historian. You could see their website for their contact information and for their publications, which are terrific. Cora Harrington is an expert on lingerie. Check out her Twitter account or X account. And then most importantly, I want to mention public figures and educators on social media who are doing incredible, incredible work. I'll name a few in alphabetical order. Bernadette Banner, Asta Darling, Nicole Rudolph, and Ivy Thompson, who goes by the solo artist.
So this is amazing. There's really a lot of information floating around out there that people are curious about. And of course, I would add your own brilliant work to all of that.
Thank you, Carl.
Well, and speaking of that, so can you give us a little teaser for your book coming up on hairdressing? We talked a little bit about that in the show we did on dressing up last year that I found fascinating. But in general terms, what have you found most surprising or most fascinating about 19th century hairdressing? I know this is going to surprise some listeners.
Thank you, Carl. My new book is called Beyond Vanity, The History and Power of Hairdressing, and it's coming out really soon by MIT Press. You can pre-order it now. The book is all about 19th century hairdressing in the United States, and I dig into some untold stories about society women, actresses, and business owners who were all setting the trends, from the pompadour to the Gibson girl bouffant, and of course, this book is lavishly illustrated. The most surprising aspect? Probably the enormous variety of recipes for homemade shampoos, and I'll leave those to your imagination.
Well, I'm somewhere back on that kerosene and those flammables with the dry cleaning. I can't imagine what people put on their hair.
The kerosene comes into play and the shampoos. How did you guess?
Oh, Liz, we could just go on and on. I am so looking forward to having you back. But I think we have covered and uncovered a lot today. Thank you so much for joining me once again.
Thank you for having me.
It is such a pleasure. And to my listeners, if you haven't read Liz's previous book, Dressing Up, The Women Who Influenced French Fashion, I encourage you to find a copy today and to follow Liz through her website, ElizabethLBlock.com, and on Instagram at ElizabethLBlock. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of The Gilded Gentleman. The Gilded Gentleman is produced by Bowery Boys Media, and this episode was edited and produced by Kieran Gannon. To stay up to date on upcoming podcasts, special tours, and events, make sure to sign up for The Gilded Gentleman monthly newsletter, and you can do that on thegildedgentleman.com. I invite my listeners to become patrons of the show on patreon.com/thegildedgentleman. Your support helps me to manage the costs of researching, writing, creating, and producing the show. I couldn't do it without you. And I'll see you soon. After all, what's life without a little glint of gold?
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.